Well, good evening and welcome to St. George's Battery Point for this inaugural Henry Baldwin Lecture. My name is Victor Shaw. I'm one of the ministers here at St. George's. And it's a great pleasure and privilege to welcome you to this lecture this evening. I just wanted to start with a couple of housekeeping things. But first of all, why don't we give Jonathan Bearcash a round of applause for entertaining us on the cello. Thank you so much, Jonathan. I'm going to invite you, if you've got a mobile phone, to take it out and turn it on silent. If you're a person who likes to take notes on your mobile, you leave it on. If you want to turn it off, that's fine as well. As you hopefully know, the toilets are through those doors there, two doors through that way, and the toilets are there. If you're kind of feeling a bit embarrassed about maybe walking in front of the stage and you need to use the loo, you can go out the back door and then kind of round through the garden path and in via the side during the lecture. But it might be raining, and we're all about grace here, so you are very welcome to just go via the inside. In case of an emergency, obviously the main exit is up the back, but you can also exit the building that way and then around to your right and through our morning tea room. And in the case of an emergency, just follow the wardens in the fire vests. Okay, I think that's all the housekeeping stuff for this evening. Well, as we begin this evening, I want to start by acknowledging the Muwinina people as the original and ongoing custodians of the land on which we gather. They're the caretakers of this land on behalf of our almighty Creator, and we acknowledge and pay respects to their elders, past and present and emerging. And we also acknowledge any other Aboriginal peoples who are present here with us this evening. Everyone is very welcome. Tonight is the inaugural Henry Baldwin Lecture. I don't know whether any of you know of who Henry is. I sadly did not have the pleasure of meeting him. But Henry was a lifelong parishioner at St. George's, Battery Point. And his two great loves were trains and the church. He was a railway engineer and travelled all over the state his whole life on the trains. And he also served here as a warden under seven rectors, so a very long time. And on his death, Henry left a generous bequest to the church. And so tonight we are launching this lecture in what we hope will be an annual lecture in his honour, in honour of his contribution to St. George's. At St. George's, we are convinced that Christian theology has the intellectual and spiritual resources to help us to navigate the challenges of contemporary life. The Hedring Baldwin Lecture aims to provide a thoughtful contribution to our public discourse, and we are delighted that you are here joining us for this inaugural lecture. So welcome. We also welcome our speaker, Dave Taylor. Dave is a philosopher from Sydney. 5 years ago, he founded Peace Talks, which is a forum where questions about politics, ethics, the arts, and culture can be explored in the context of openness and hospitality. And this is hosted by St. George's, another St. George's Anglican Church in Paddington in Sydney. Dave also hosts a weekly podcast called The Eucatastrophe with his friend Joel Harrison, who's a lecturer in law and religion at the University of Sydney. The Eucatastrophe is a podcast exploring true human ends and how life may be enchanted. And Dave and Joel meander and banter through politics, pop culture, church, and society to explore how a theological imagination creatively envisages and serves the common good. Dave works in disability research at the Centre for Disability Studies at Sydney University, and he attends St. Anne's Anglican Church, Strathfield, and we're delighted to welcome him this evening. And I should also add, it's a great pleasure for me, because Dave and I have been friends since we were about 12. This is kind of a little in-house event for us. And we're delighted that you can come and join in our conversation at least. And look, we hope it's going to be enlightening and stimulating, a blessing for you. The format of our evening will be that Dave speaks for about 35 minutes or so, and then we'll have a bit of a discussion together with some Q&A, and there'll be a microphone that is handed around, as well as you'll be able to text your questions through as well. So I think that's about it in terms of where we are going. So welcome again this evening. It is so good to see you, and thank you so much for coming out on a wet Tuesday night. But let me introduce to you our topic for this evening, loneliness and the search for the self, and our speaker, Dave Taylor. Put your hands together.
Hello, can you hear me? Can everybody hear me? Great. Well, thank you so much for that warm welcome, and thank you so much, Victor, for the invitation, and to St. George's. It's wonderful to be here, and it's wonderful to be enjoying your beautiful city. I've been particularly enjoying walking around the streets in the afternoon, admiring your beautiful sunsets and your beautiful bird life here. It's an incredible place to live. I'm very happy to be talking to you about a subject that I've thought quite a bit about. Loneliness is something that seems to pique people's interest. I wrote my first thesis on the topic of loneliness in philosophy, in political philosophy in particular. And the unusual thing that happened when I told people I was writing a thesis on loneliness is, unlike when you tell someone what you're writing about generally, people actually were interested when I told them I was writing on loneliness, rather than having that glazed look as I start talking about Heidegger and things like that. So it's obviously something that piques people's interest. And it seems to be something that draws a crowd, so much so that I'm a bit worried about Hobart, if this is something that you're so interested in. So loneliness. Loneliness is something that is becoming more and more of a central feature or a central concern of our society. One study that I read not too long ago suggested that 1 in 6 Australians report experiencing prolonged periods of intense emotional loneliness and isolation. There's even been a number of medical studies looking at the physiological consequences of prolonged loneliness, including things like diabetes, increased rate of heart disease, early death, as well as a plethora of mental health conditions, including profound and deep depression. But it's not just a health concern either. Many people are starting to write about concerns about the way in which loneliness is shaping contemporary public discourse, how loneliness might be shaping our public interactions. Psychologists now talk about a condition, or the condition of loneliness, as causing a condition called hypervigilance for social threat. An article in The Guardian from 2015 describes this condition like this. In this state, that is hypervigilance for social threat, which is entered into unknowingly, the individual becomes hyper alert to rejection, growing increasingly inclined to perceive social interactions as tinged with hostility or scorn. The result is a vicious cycle of withdrawal in which the lonely person becomes increasingly suspicious, intensifying their social isolation. Some argue, for obvious reasons, I think, that hypervigilance for social threat is enabled, intensified, and promoted by social media. Take, for example, Sherry Turkle's famous book, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. In it, she links social media to loneliness in various ways. You see, social media seems to promise so much in terms of connectivity, but leaves many feeling utterly isolated and empty. One reason identified by Terkel is that through social media, we only ever interact with one another through a censored, curated simulacrum of the self, and as such, feel utterly lonely because we're only ever being related to through a mask that we put out there, through an advertisement that we construct for ourselves. More on this a bit later. For these reasons and more, loneliness has also become a concern of the state, with ministerial positions being created to combat loneliness. In the UK, it was a big discussion point when I was there about 5 or so years ago, and similar roles being piloted in parts of Australia as well. But what if there's an even bigger problem with loneliness? Consider the following quote. What prepares men for totalitarian domination in the non-totalitarian world is the fact that loneliness, once a borderline experience usually suffered in certain marginal social conditions like old age, has become an everyday experience of the ever-growing masses of the century. That quote is from Hannah Arendt's masterpiece, The Origins of Totalitarianism. The Origins of Totalitarianism was a work written by Hannah Arendt, a German Jewish philosopher and political theorist who had fled to the US after the rise of the Nazis, who sought to search the entire Western tradition to answer that one fundamental question of how on earth did a liberal democracy transform into a Nazi state? How was totalitarianism possible? How was it possible to turn people on their fellow human beings in such unbelievable numbers? Her answer to that lies in some profound way in the loneliness of the modern condition. Why does Arendt see loneliness as the preparation for totalitarianism? Well, Arendt argued that lonely people are particularly susceptible to ideology because they lack the usual social resources needed to make sense of themselves and the world around them. For Arendt, we don't simply come to understand and accept reality alone as individuals, at least under normal healthy conditions. Instead, we understand and trust in the reality of our experience through what she calls a common sense. That is, through the confidence that we have, or that we come to have in the reality of our experience of the world, simply because we share it in common with our fellow human beings. This shared experience is made physical in our places, such as cities, which ought to be carriers of collective memory. But once we become cut off from one another, once we lose connection to our neighbours, to our political community, once we lose a possibility of contributing to our society, contributing to our material places even, we fall into a state where we lose the capacity to distinguish between truth and lies. So for Arendt, the totalitarian world is one where our normal categorizations of things like true and false, right and wrong, legal and illegal become meaningless. This might begin to sound a bit familiar. Ideology for a lonely person is a substitute for common sense. It represents an attempt to describe all of reality under the banner of a single idea, particularly an idea about the nature of history as a process. So for the ideological racist, history was the process through which a particular race would come to dominate others. Or in the Soviet world, history was the inevitable process of the emancipation of the proletariat, with the state acting as its mere instrument. Or in the context of types of religious fundamentalism, history might be conceived of as a progress towards an inevitable war between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. Lonely people, for Arendt, and I think she is right, are susceptible to this kind of thinking because they are cut off from shared experiences that reinforce the reality of the world and are thrown back on the hell
that is the attempt to make sense of the world in isolation. This, I believe, is part of an explanation of why today we see so many people, especially young men, flocking their thousands to internet gurus who can make the world simple for them. There is a beautiful depiction, although a rather bleak depiction, of this internal push of the lonely person towards authority figures in the second season of a wonderful television series called Fleabag from the BBC. Fleabag tells the story of a young woman racked by guilt and grief over the death of her best friend, who turns to alcoholism, compulsive sex, and antisocial behaviour as a comfort, or perhaps even a type of self-flagellation to deal with guilt. In the second season, she falls madly in love with a perhaps equally dysfunctional Catholic priest. In one scene, after some drinking, the priest invites our heroine, an outspoken, sarcastic atheist, into the confessional. The scene begins with the woman seemingly delighting in recounting her various sexual exploits and sins. I was going to show you that part, but I think it was a bit too naughty for our hallowed setting. But after recounting this and regaling the priest with this confession of salacious activities, there's all of a sudden a change, and a genuine confession comes out.
I'm ashamed of not knowing what I...
What you want? It's okay not to know what you want.
No, I know what I want. I know exactly what I want. Right now.
What's that?
It's bad.
It's okay.
I want someone to tell me what to wear in the morning.
Okay, well, I think there are people who can...
No, I want someone to tell me what to wear every morning. I want someone to tell me what to eat, what to like, what to hate, what to rage about, what to listen to, what band to like, what to buy tickets for, what to joke about, what not to joke about. I want someone to tell me what to believe in, who to vote for, and who to love, and how to tell them. I just think I want someone to tell me how to live my life, Father, because so far I think I've been getting it wrong. But I know that's why people want people like you in their lives. Because you just tell them how to do it. You just tell them what to do and what they'll get out at the end of it. Even though I don't believe your bullshit, and I know that scientifically nothing that I do makes any difference in the end anyway, I'm still scared. Why am I still scared?
It's one of my favourite scenes in television for a very long time, from a brilliant show. Is anyone familiar with Fleabag? It's wonderful. I think this is a very powerful depiction of the modern condition in many ways. There's so much more to say about that whole, especially what happens next, which I won't spoil, which is quite upsetting, but one of the things it shows us is this terror that is caused by being thrown back on our individual experience to try and make sense of the world and the problems that this may lead to. You see, in isolation, we are thrown back onto ourselves to make sense of the world, and in desperation, we long for easy answers. And, unfortunately, strong figures who will guide us to the light. Hence some of geopolitics at the moment, I believe. One of the most tragic features of this loss of a common sense of shared experience is a loss of a solid sense of self. Unlike in ages past, we live in a society that demands we find our true or authentic self. And we have whole industries designed to sell us just that kind of self. In ages past, we would find our identity in a close fixed community where family, church, profession, and class all came together to provide a constellation of identity for us. We would know who we are through this matrix of fixed features. This is not the case for us today. I'm not saying that that shift is a bad thing. I'm just saying it comes with some baggage. Today, all these things are up for grabs. We cycle through our jobs, seemingly weekly for many. Many of us can't find work, and when we can find work, it's precarious gig work. In Sydney, we commute on average around an hour each way to work so that we don't have any time for those chance social encounters with our neighbours that would have been central to our social experience in days gone by. Indeed, some would argue that even our current approach to the creation of built urban spaces builds loneliness into our day-to-day experience. Writing in 1975, architectural theorist Richard Thomas recounted the emergence of the suburb as a modern phenomenon made possible by the advent of the automobile. In an essay called From Porch to Patio, Thomas described the modern American suburban home replacing the porch, that is the front veranda, as the primary place for spending downtime, with the patio, an enclosed back veranda. This closed each household off from their neighbours. Rather than creating a porous boundary or border from public to private, the individual family was cut off from their neighbours. And so we can trace that rise of a lonely, isolated society in suburban spaces, even in architecture. Closed off from others, we lose a sense of self. One difficulty with this experience is that it makes thinking unbearable. Returning to Hannah Arendt, she saw thinking as a type of dialogue between all of the voices that we have internalized through our reading, our studies, our social life, our interactions in the public sphere. So thought for her was literally a conversation. When we engage in deep thought and reflection, we lose a sense of ourself, and the self dissolves away and we become a conversation, a concophony of different voices. That's the experience of thought for her, and that deeply resonates with my own experience. I don't know whether it resonates with your own. And this, I might add, is why intellectual types are often so weird and miserable and dysfunctional. Indeed, the only thing that makes this kind of thinking bearable is the knowledge that I will soon return to those who know me best, and I will see in their eyes a recognition of me, as a singular individual, and not just a noisy cacophony of internal voices. Now, those of you who are writers, or artists, or academics, or poets, will probably understand the relief of that experience of coming in back to a loved one, back to a friend, after spending time in your own head in that mess, and then being reaffirmed as a singular individual. We need community to be truly ourselves. We can only truly embrace ourselves as ourselves through this experience of being recognized by another. Now, this has some very deep resonances with Christian theology. One of the first statements that we hear about humanity during the creation narrative of the book of Genesis is that it is not good that man is alone. And so we are told that God created woman, and at last humanity was complete. This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh, says Adam, seeing Eve for the first time. Now, we are apt to be very suspicious of this passage because of the gender assumptions that it brings and reinforces. But nevertheless, there is some basic truth here that I think ought to resonate deeply with our souls. We are not truly ourselves until we see ourselves in the face of another. We are not fully human without community. Something that makes sense, I think, if we go deeper into theology, when we consider that humanity, according to Genesis, was built to bear the image of the divine, who is one, but three at the same time, who is unity and community. The individual, therefore, can't bear the image of God without first loving their neighbor, being in community and together reflecting the Trinity. We can't be fully human without community. We can't be fully reflective of the divine life without love. But it's not simply community that we need to be truly ourselves. We also require solitude. This is incredibly important for a number of reasons. First, if a fundamental way that we find ourselves is in the face of those closest to us, this makes us incredibly vulnerable to toxic and abusive relationships. In such relationships, a powerful party is in some sense able to dominate the very identity of another, the very self of the other. And the tragedy is that those in such relationships internalize the stories that are told about them by the powerful. Of course, people in such situations also need community of others who can challenge the stories that abusers tell. But there must also be the possibility for solitude, a capacity to withdraw and strip away the cacophony of competing stories that without the possibility of solitude would dominate our very self. But it's not just people in abusive or toxic relationships that require this kind of solitude. We can all, I believe, become fixated with the way in which we exist in the minds of others. This can lead us to turn our entire life into a kind of performance, where how we appear to others becomes the central project of our lives rather than the cultivation of an authentic character. Jesus brought a new term into our moral lexicon for this condition: hypocrisy. To be a hypocrite simply means to be an actor. Jesus uses this term to describe people whose entire life is spent simply performing a role. But like most sins, hypocrisy is its own punishment. We come to realize that we have allowed the role that we play to become our whole existence, and then in moments of realization, we look within and see that there is nothing there apart from the role that we've played. We become hollow men and women and other. We feel lonely because there is no true self to be known at all. And this is one of the most tragic experiences of human life, I believe. This is beautifully depicted in the film I Heart Huckabees, which depicts a series of people who engage the services of a pair of existential detectives to surveil them for 24/7 for a whole week in order to help to work out the meaning of their life with all of its coincidences. One character, a sleazy businessman played by Jude Law, hires the detectives just to annoy one of the other characters by kind of co-opting their quest for meaning. This backfires when the existential detectives play back to Jude Law's character a recording of him telling the same anecdote over and over and over again. It happens to be an anecdote about him meeting Shania Twain, and he every day in different business meetings, he's telling the same story over and over and over again. And this is what happens following that playback.
All right, I don't have to tell stories.
What do you think would happen if you didn't tell the stories? Are you being yourself?
How am I not myself?
How am I not myself?
Myself.
How am I not myself?
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 How am I not?
yourself.
In a following scene, he goes to a board meeting and is asked to recount the anecdote again, and he vomits. The answer to hypocrisy, that is, a life concerned with just playing a role, the answer to toxic narratives that others might impose on us, is solitude, and I dare say prayer. Solitude and prayer. In prayer, we are taught to give up on self-justification and sit in the presence of an other that knows us fully. This can be terrifying, as at times we fear that if all the lies that we tell ourselves about ourselves, if they were to disappear, there wouldn't be anything left. Or we might have so internalized the negative stories that others tell us about ourselves that we feel unworthy to be in the presence of the divine. Yet the Christian believes that the nature of the divine can be seen in the person of Christ, who knows the human heart perfectly, takes on human nature, yet loves us even in all of our mess. Furthermore, he loves us in our dysfunction to such an extent that he lets it do its worst to him in suffering a violent and unjust death. The good news of Easter, that is, the good news of the resurrection, is the sign that his perfect love cannot be extinguished even by the worst of our wickedness, and that allows us to bear solitude. And so for the Christian to learn to pray is fundamentally about learning to stop the game of self-justification, to stop believing our own propaganda and accept unconditional love and acceptance. And I would suggest that even if you are someone who is not religious, I would invite you to try this practice, simply sitting and being and stop justifying yourself. Even as a thought experiment, imagine that there is a God that knows everything about you, yet loves you unconditionally. And that, I think, is a powerful anecdote to a lot of the toxic stories and toxic voices that are contained within our head, many of which are our own. So to find a self, to combat loneliness, we need two things. We need community and we need solitude. And this is the tragedy of our culture, in my opinion. We have created a society based on virtually mediated forms of togetherness, social media. What I think this constitutes is a perpetual, hellish half-presence, where we are never truly alone, yet never truly in community. The clamor of the voices of the public sphere is sitting waiting for you now in your pocket, on your phone. Studies are now starting to show the effect that this is happening on our brains, particularly the brains of our youth. As children and young people live in a state of constant vigilance, waiting for a notification that will reinforce their sense of belonging. This is changing our neurological makeup. But it's also a form of community based on a curated, cultivated identity, our own propaganda or advertisement for the person that we want people to think we are. And so the question remains, what can we do to resist this culture of loneliness? Well, I would suggest something like deliberately seeking forms of local community where we are forced to interact with people that we wouldn't necessarily or ordinarily choose to, and yet we are committed to joining nonetheless. Joining things like community gardens, reading groups, community action groups, walking groups, volunteer organizations, these are wonderful ways of resisting the culture of isolation and loneliness. volunteer organizations where you're committed to be a presence to another who is committed to be a presence to you. Finding those spaces is a wonderful way of resisting. One experiment that I've tried a number of times in a number of different communities is getting a group of people together who don't know each other particularly well and getting them to take turns sharing a piece of art, a poem, a clip from a film, a song, or a passage from a book, and asking them to say a few words about what they've just shared means for them. I find this to be an utterly profound experience. All of a sudden, you feel like you're understanding, by understanding what a person finds beautiful, what moves them, you feel like you know them on a deep and profound level, even if you've just met them. And you even begin to feel a level of compassion you might not be expecting for people who you might have deep disagreements with on a number of levels. This is an incredibly powerful aspect of art, to open up our inner lives to one another through shared experience. I want to finish now by showing you a clip that illustrates this power of art to bring people together. It's part of a discussion between two musicians. One of them is electronica artist Björk, and the other one is an Estonian minimalist composer of sacred music named Arvo Part. This is a fascinating conversation.
Arvo Part was born in Estonia and lives now in Berlin. I like your music very, very much because you give space to the listener. He can go inside and live there. But a lot of music from last few centuries, you just have to sit and listen.
Maybe it is because I need space for myself, even if I am working. I think the sound is a very interesting phenomenon. Mm-hmm. You can, why the people like and are so influenced of music, they don't know how strong the music influences us, mm-hmm. good or bad. Mm-hmm. If it is, you can kill people with sound. Mm-hmm. And if you can kill, then you can, maybe there is also the sound, which is something opposite of killing.
Yeah.
And the distance between these two points mm-hmm. is very big.
Yeah.
And you are free. You can choose. In art, everything is possible, but everything what is made is not necessary.
There is a question and answer, the different voices inside your music. It's almost like Pinocchio and little cricket, and so one is like human and always doing mistake or pain or making pain to other, and the little cricket is more like comfort him or tell him, you know. Do you feel it is inside your music, or maybe I imagine?
I'm very happy about that you talk about it. It's really so. And this new style, it consists two ways, two sides. So that one line is my sins, and another line is forgiveness to these sins. Mostly the music has two voices. One is more complicated and subjective, mm-hmm. but another is very simple, clear, and objective. But Pinocchio is a good thing.
I find that clip
I don't know what you made of it. I happen to be really big into both of those musicians, so I'm a bit biased. But I find the clip absolutely amazing because it demonstrates the capacity for art to bring people together in their subjective experience in this profound, deep way, almost mystical. Arvo Pärt is a minimalist composer. His music is very, very simple. Yet in hearing it, Björk is able to hear and feel what was most deeply true and sacred for Arvo Pärt. And this is simply amazing. She could hear in his music the chaos and moral guilt that he experienced, yet the assurance of his experience of forgiveness in a simple piece of minimalist neoclassical sacred music. If art has that power to join hearts and minds together, to share subjective experience, there may be some hope for a lonely and isolated community if we can harness its power. And so I'd like to finish by saying what a privilege it is to be in a city that is attempting something just like this, bringing a community together through a shared experience of art. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dave, for just a really, really stimulating lecture. Now I've got a couple of assistants who are going to, and hopefully Joel can help as well with this, move our lectern, but not move our SMS number up here so that people can SMS their questions in. We'll take those in a moment. I've just received a message here that there's a car blocking the driveway outside the church with Rego FG7112. If you're able to move that, that would be much appreciated. Okay.
Oh, thank Thanks. You.
There we go. And let's see if we can get that computer back up. Otherwise, nobody will be able to SMS questions and we'll be in trouble. I'll leave that with you, Joel. Thanks. So we've got an opportunity now for some questions, both via SMS and via our roving mic. David has our roving mic, and if you'd like to ask a question, just stick up your hand. And Dave will take that. And the questions are coming to my phone. And so as they come in, we can answer those as well. Dave, thank you so much for what is just a really, really stimulating lecture. And I was really taken by your talking about the need for community and resisting that kind of hellish in-between space of social media where you're neither in real community nor in real solitude, but you're kind of in this awful half-life. And you suggested that one of the ways that we can resist that is through different forms of local community. I guess my question is, I see that there's communities that are voluntarily entered into can be voluntarily kind of exited, and sometimes involuntarily exited. You know, we might find that circumstances in our life means that we're no longer able to kind of be present and participate in that sort of community. So, and we might find in that sense that we find ourselves alone. So maybe my question, I guess, is how can we overcome the limitations of ourself in finding ourselves in a community which is going to stick with us even when we might not be there?
That's a really good question. It's very, very difficult because part of the modern condition is an assault on kind of commitment to anything. And so we have the wonderful advent of the maybe option on Facebook events and things like that. So it is...
I'm glad to see nobody talk here tonight.
Wonderful. So yeah, it's really difficult. And so part of it is that you need to make your own commitment, realizing that unless you won't get the goods that you derive from being part of a community, unless you're actually committed yourself, unless you turn up even when it's slightly inconvenient. The most amazing examples of community that I find are communities based around common interests or goals. I was talking last night at another talk about some of the odd communities that I'm part of. So I work in the area of disability, doing disability studies, working mainly with people with intellectual disability. And the thing I love about the disability space is that it's occupied by people from such diametrically opposed worldviews. It's made up of people who are like LGBT plus activists, conservative Christians, all sorts of different people. But they come together and work together because they have a common desire to see people that are alienated from the rest of society are honoured in some way. And those are the spaces where I think real possibilities for community open up, ways of kind of resisting this kind of atomizing, polarizing time. And you see, I see the same thing in advocacy for asylum seekers, advocacy for climate change, although I wish more conservative Christians would be interested in that issue. So those are the areas where I do see it. It's areas where there is a joint common goal and project. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we're living in an age where people are less willing to cross identity markers, cross ideological lines in order to pursue a good that even they believe in, but they don't want to be identified with the other people that happen to believe in it as well. Mm-hmm. And that's a real difficulty.
We are getting a whole lot of great questions here on SMS. That's why my head's been down trying to parse all of those. So I've got one here. Maybe I should say, if you can add your name when you send the text through so that I can just acknowledge you there. But here's a great question. Can you have a sense of a community? Paul asked this question. Wow, that's very impressive. Can you have a sense of community, have a community and a sense of community in the absence of a grand narrative in a society seemingly torn apart between multiple competing religions and ideologies? Great question.
That's a wonderful question. Thank you. I truly believe it is that we can. I deeply believe we can. I think there is always overlapping desire for common goods. In all sorts of ways, different community groups will be orientated towards overlapping goods.
Mm.
And it's learning to, rather than being suspicious of other groups who have competing narratives, identifying the good, the common project that's happening within them. Mm. So with my Islamic brothers and sisters, even though I myself am not a Muslim, I respect and honor them because I recognize in that community the pursuit of the divine. And that is a pursuit that I recognize. And I hope that in all sorts of different competing narratives, whether they're political narratives and things like that, we can stop kind of trying to demonize each other and recognize in different narratives that people hopefully are genuinely pursuing some good that I can recognize and honor.
Mm. Mm.
So I think community with people with different narratives is not just possible, but it's vital for the survival of our community.
Yeah. It's really interesting as you kind of talk about that, you know, as a Christian minister. I think from the Christian narrative, this is where the concept of grace is such a powerful one, because it's a concept which says we don't accept other people because they're like us, but we accept other people because God has made us and loves us all equally. And so even where I find that's difficult, in the Christian tradition at least, I've got a moral obligation to, you know, to see the other person. Thank you for that, Dave. Okay, I've got another one here. In our modern way of relating to one another via social media, this predisposes us to loneliness. Michael asks, why do we find this so appealing? So if social media is kind of that hellish half space, why is it so appealing to us? What's hooked us in there?
So I think I have a relatively complicated answer to that. There was a famous article, I think it was doing the rounds, I think it might have been New York Times or one of those publications that those type of people share. I'm not sure. the question was, is Facebook making us lonely? And the answer offered, I think, very insightfully, was that no, it's not making us lonely. It's the product of a lonely society. Mm. So it's not causing the loneliness. It is the type of social structure that a lonely populace makes. In the same way as I was talking about with the house, the housing situation, or the patio replacing the porch. That is the production of a lonely society, in that there's deep structures in our society that make us suspicious of one another, that make us seek autonomy and salvation from our neighbour at all costs. And so we create forms of togetherness where we can be in charge of the interaction. We can curate the kinds of voices that we want to hear. And in doing that, we kind of create these neat little bubbles that make us very surprising when certain people get elected. Very surprising when certain people get elected, and things like that. So it's appealing to us because it touches into a very toxic thread in our culture where we assume that liberty means liberty from my neighbour.
Yeah. Wow. That is a really profound point, Dave. And we've actually got a question which kind of follows on from that, I think. And then maybe I'll take one from the floor. So do you think that the sense of individualistic freedom bred in democratic societies contributes to segregation in communities and separation from our neighbours? And thank you, Dell, for that question.
Could you say that again?
Yeah. So, do you think that the sense of individualistic freedom bred in democratic societies contributes to segregation in communities and separation from our neighbours?
Yeah, good question. I mean, it's obviously going to be a feedback in that certain communities will tend to cluster in different ways together, but also people experiencing similar social conditions will also generate similar ideas about what's wrong with society. So it's a dialogue between social conditions and the communities that are experiencing those social conditions, I think. But in a way, yes, I think our understanding of what it means to be free, what it means to be autonomous, it seems to be fundamentally at odds with forming genuine community, because we've been taught, I would say, and if you were at my paper last night, I'd say since the 17th century, we've been taught that freedom means the free pursuit of my arbitrary desires, whatever my desire happens to be, and any competing voice from the community that might, or any competing obligation that might come up to my neighbours that would prevent me pursuing the goods that I want, must be flattened out, must be pushed away. Mm. So that might be, I don't like seeing the homeless person on my way to work, because that might generate in me an obligation to feel like I might need to contribute to that person's life, whether it's through providing services or something like that. And so I take the other street so I don't have to walk past them every morning. That's a very simple example. But
yeah, I mean, it reminds me of that line from The Matrix where Mouse says after Neo's been on the, I don't know whether anyone remembers this film, when Neo's been on that simulation where he runs into the woman in red, and Mouse says to him, I can arrange a date for you, if you like. And then all the others kind of have a go at him, and he says, oh, look, don't listen to them. To deny our impulses is to deny the very thing that makes us human. Mm. And you're saying, Dave, that actually that kind of approach to our humanity is actually problematic because it means that other people and our obligations to other people can be an impediment to my freedom, and therefore, I need to be alone in that sense.
And we're also in a society that teaches us that we're in a body of politic that's made up of competing desires, that we're in competition with each other at all times, that there's not enough to go around, and if I don't accumulate it, someone else will. And that's not a really great, that's not very conducive to community, to form a body politic on the assumption that we are all in conflict. The underlying kind of narrative is one of a war of competing desires, a war for limited resources. How are we meant to love our neighbours when that is the raison d'etre of our community?
Yeah. I'm going to take some questions from the floor as well. I'll ask one more from the my phone here while David takes the mic around. So just while David is finding this person. No, we're right. Here we go. Yes. Do you want to ask a question? Thank you.
Is this can you hear me? Good. Okay. You mentioned right at the end of your lecture that art and the consumption of art, particularly in a community-based section, can help to alleviate loneliness. I was just wondering whether or not you feel like that, whilst I agree to a certain extent that that's the case, that's maybe too idealistic a position to take, because there are many instances in society where art can actually be used in an instrumental fashion towards propagating, you mentioned before the fact that authoritarian types of ideologies can sweep in during times of loneliness as well.
Yeah.
And I don't think that art is necessarily anti-authoritarian by its nature. So I just wonder if you comment on the potential idealistic impact of art.
That's a wonderful question. Thank you. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. There's nothing guaranteed about the capacity of art to create community, and also art can be used very destructively to alienate communities, to demonize minorities, to do all things, sorts of things that are not conducive to community. I would actually just see art as a possible answer in particular circumstances to this sense of isolation, and it has to be done in the context of an actual relationship, a face-to-face relationship. I actually get the argument from an essay by Tolstoy called What is Art? Where he believed that authentic art needed to be the genuine, authentic expression of some felt emotion of the artist. And he thinks that when someone goes and experiences an artwork that is an authentic experience of expression of a lived, true emotion, and someone sees that and then feels the emotion that the artist felt, he says our metaphysical isolation is dissolved, and we join souls, if you like. And it becomes even more so if there's a community of people engaging with an artwork and come together and are joint in their feeling of something. But there's nothing, I think that's a very... it's a wonderful story to tell about art. I don't know how exact and accurate it is about the artistic process and things like that. But nevertheless, that when I read that essay, it deeply resonated with me. And I think of times in which I've bonded with people over a share love of an artwork. On a very superficial level, you'll notice most people love sharing their favourite song with someone else or forcing people on a car trip to listen to that favourite song. Why is that? Why? What are you trying to do there? You're trying to open up what this emotional reality is for you to that other person and have a shared experience over it. There's something, I think, deeply, I would, as a religious person, you say that there's something mystical about that. But, you know, I had one experience that I think of was I went to see Terrence Malick's film Tree of Life at the cinema.
Did we go together, Dave?
I don't think so.
Really?
No.
It's a long time ago, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted.
So I went with a group of people.
Not me.
It's a dense, confusing, and alienating film for many people. Very stream of consciousness, but it's essentially about human misery in the context of creation as a whole. Everyone I went with was baffled and left immediately. And I sat in the cinema overwhelmed, and I looked over and I saw another person having the same experience. And we saw each other and we felt less, well, I felt less alone. And I think that's the power of art, to bring minds and souls together.
I've got another question here, and then we'll take that one up the back. Is there a point at which a person has been out of community too long to be able to enter back in?
Oh, gosh. That is a very good question and a very dark question. I have worked with people who have been institutionalized in different ways, and there is the damage that does is hard to overstate. But another, I have to be careful because I've seen this in professional settings. In a professional context. But at the same time, even people who have spent a lifetime in an institution from the age of 10 to the age of 50, you do see little glimmers of humanity kind of coming back in through the expertise and love of good human beings in their life. So in that sense, I truly believe that restoration to community in some way is possible for every soul. At the very least, I take comfort in the fact that I think that everyone has some sort of relationship to the divine that knows the mysteries of that person and what's going on to that person, even if their inner life is unintelligible to everyone else.
Yeah, that question reminds me of a scene from a film that I know you enjoyed immensely, Calvary, where Calvary, if you haven't seen it, fantastic film. It's about a town in Ireland grappling in the aftermath of the child sexual abuse scandals among the clergy, and it's a priest kind of trying to pastor this town, and it's kind of a week in his life. And in one day, and you see him going and visiting all the different members of the community in all their dysfunction. And one of those is he goes to jail, and he visits a young man who has murdered all these women, and kind of says he can't remember where he put the bodies. And one of the other characters asks him, like, why are you doing this? And he has this sense of, no, this person too is not beyond the grace of God. There's a wonderful line in the film where he says, God is great and the limits of his mercy have not been set. And you see him doing that in the town, like with all these people who are just kind of, they hate him. Mm. But he's operating under that conviction that actually nobody is beyond the reach of our common humanity. Mm. Now, he's coming from a religious perspective on that. But it's a very hopeful moment in that film.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
We've got a question up the back.
Hi, my name is Teresa, and I have a problem with loneliness. I came to this event because of that problem. And I'm also a user of social media, and I grew up in this town and I have lots of acquaintances and friends and so on. I'm wondering, what's your view on cancelling your social media accounts? Because I have been in the process of deactivating and then reactivating and then deactivating.
Yeah.
No? And I'm just wondering if you've ever done that.
Yeah.
Have you deleted?
Yeah. That's a great question. So I did stop using social media for about 6 months. And then I went through a very hard time. I experienced the loss of a family member. And then went through some other difficulties that I won't go into. But that was an incredibly isolating and alienating time. And I went back to social media because I couldn't really bear to interact with people face to face for a while. And now my podcast partner forces me to run the social media accounts for the podcast, which is often terrible, because it turns out if you put opinions out into the world, people respond. When I was not using social media, that was incredibly liberating, and I think I am going to stop using it apart from my podcasting stuff. But one of the things you notice is that it's built into the way that we organize our social life now. And so you end up finding out you miss out on what's going on for people, you miss out on invitations to events, you miss out on invitations to social gatherings and stuff like that. That was just one observation that I made. Not that I like going out anyway. So, but that was my experience. And you know, what I was trying to say in my talk was not that, was that social media seems to be the best that we can do as a society. It's the best we can do as far as a type of togetherness goes. And for me, when I was going through that experience of grief and depression and things like that, that was the best I could do as far as social activity goes. That's, I suppose, my answer. Give it a go.
We've got another question up the back there. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your talk. I heard echoes in some of the things you were saying of the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor coming through there. And as you know, he argues that the secular West has done all it can to remove the transcendent, the enchanted from our world. That we've buffered ourselves away, we're now living behind a screen, but actually we've failed, we can't do it. Mm. And he says we're now haunted by the absence of the transcendent, and there are parts, there are things in our culture and our society which reveal our hauntedness. Mm. Mm. And he says one of those things is in the modern arts, that artists are in fact giving voice to the loss of divine. And I'm just wondering what you think about that, whether you think he's onto something, and I wonder whether the loneliness that we are experiencing in a culture could be because we've buffered ourselves away from the one who can be present with us at all times, the transcendent God.
Yeah. Good comments. I mean, I didn't get to go to any of the... I walked around the outside of Dartmoor for a bit. While I was here, but I have been to Mona a couple of times, and I find Mona interesting in that, from what I understand, it's an attempt to build a art space within a purely immanent frame, that is, within the material realm. And then it's interesting that you've got Dark Mofo that seems to, as far as what I could see as I was walking around the streets, be curious about the transcendent rather than the immanent. Even when you have upside-down crosses, as you have in the past, you are still playing with the divine there, even in its absence. And I think even when you are seriously attempting to deny the existence of the divine, you are still in relation to it. And so that's one of the things that I notice whenever there's an attempt to have arts within a purely immanent material frame. It is still in relationship to the divine, but in the negative, but the divine still haunts it. But as far as does secularization, as Charles Taylor, does the creation of a buffered self, does that contribute to loneliness? I believe that part of Taylor's answer to that, and part of my own answer to that,
being a different Taylor.
Be a different Taylor. I've been trying to start a rumor that I'm his nephew for a long time, but
yeah. Anyway.
No relation. Part of his answer to that would actually be, no, we are irreligious because we're lonely. That we had loneliness and social atomization and isolation built in to the modern Western political imaginary. And that changed the way in which we thought about religion, which in turn leads to the loss of faith in society, losing faith in God, and God just being an option that's available to us. So I'm someone that thinks that part of the common sense that a community provides is my faith, and that's why for me I can't be a religious person outside of a faith community, because I realize that on my own I have nothing within myself to generate the faith necessary to be a religious person, to be a faithful person. And I need to borrow the faith of my fellow parishioners and my communion to be a Christian. And so I would say it's actually, in a strange way, the other way around, that our loneliness makes us unreligious. It's not our lack of religion that's necessarily making us lonely, but that might be part of the story as well.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. If there's any other questions from the floor, I've got a really fascinating question here. You spoke of the necessity for solitude. Can you elaborate on what you see the difference between solitude and loneliness to be? And do you think some loneliness is necessary to appreciate community?
Yeah, I would say that loneliness is the emotional experience of isolation, that is, being removed for prolonged periods away from your community, whereas solitude is an active and willed withdrawal from the public, withdrawal from the community. And so they're similar but distinct. And solitude can be lifelong. You see this in the monastic tradition. These people who, you know, I've been saying all night, you need community in order to be fully human. But I think the great saints, who are the most human people alive, who have chosen isolation, who have chosen solitude rather, and withdrawn from society, have such love in their hearts that they have the world inside them, that they then bring before the divine in constant prayer. I was reminded of this. Someone that I absolutely adore was and is Sister Wendy. Does anyone remember Sister Wendy, the nun art critic who was doing TV shows in the 90s? I had a couple of glasses of wine one night and then went on YouTube and looked up some videos of Sister Wendy. Just because, you know, wild lifestyle that I live. And then I realized, like, I'd seen her as a child and thought, this is really funny. It's this nun who talks about, you know, penises unashamedly a lot and things like that. But then I realized, oh, she's actually a genius. And in one interview I saw, she talked about the experience of being a cloistered nun, of being someone that spends most of her days alone in prayer. And she talked about it with such joy that God had called her to so love her fellow human beings that she does nothing but present them before God in solitude. So solitude is not the opposite of community. It can be actually a willing embrace of your fellow human being by presenting them and offering them to God in prayer. That's probably a long answer to a question that wasn't asked, which is my the philosophical specialty.
Yeah, that's okay. Yes, we might have time for a couple more questions. I've got like a billion and one text messages here, and they're all such good questions. It's very hard to know which ones to ask here. I've got a really interesting question that there's been a few here around Julian Assange and his experience of loneliness there. So the question is, Assange is lonely through social abandonment after the exposure of our true society. Is history repeating itself?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure I understand the question. Would you like to have a go?
Yep, okay, I'll have a go at that one. Goodness, that is quite a difficult question. That's why I was asking you.
I mean, yes. So my master's thesis was looking at expressly the way in which the state can show its power over people precisely by abandoning them, by withdrawing from it. So when the state denationalizes someone, removes their citizenship, it is both putting someone outside of itself, but at the same time showing power over it. I think this is one of the most insidious forms of power relation possible. And it is a type of abandonment and a type of power that I don't think should be within the arsenal of a civilized country. Is that enough of an answer?
Yeah, I think that'll be good. Do we have any more questions from the floor? Yes, one over here. This will be our last question.
Do you think that fundamentalism attracts lonely people?
Yeah, absolutely. Tell you what, there's an episode of the most recent episode of my podcast, The U Catastrophe, which, by the way, is spelt catastrophe, but with EU in the front of it.
It's just nothing to do with EU being the prefix for good in Greek.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
The good
great.
Catastrophe.
Yeah.
My most recent podcast episode, I talked about my own experience of faith and the great resources that a more fundamentalist brand of faith gave me as a young man, the sense of self-efficacy and self-respect that form of religion gave me. I wasn't like a hardcore fundamentalist, but that experience gave me great sympathy for people who are caught up in all sorts of fundamentalisms, whether it's kind of Christian fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism, or even movements like incels and these toxic masculine movements and things like that. I can deeply sympathize and understand the emotional resources that those kinds of answers can give you. But I would say if you genuinely want to be religious, and you want easy answers, don't look to Christianity. At least don't look to what I understand to be Orthodox Christianity. Of course, it will just make everything messy and complicated in my experience.
Yeah, man, I did a theology degree because I had lots of questions, and it did not help. It just gave me a whole lot more, and I kind of felt that I needed to help others along finding more questions, perhaps. So I guess that's partly why I'm here. But yeah, I can agree with you on that one, that that Christianity is not a place of easy answers. But it's been, you know, I think for both of us in different ways, it's been a great place from which to explore the world and consider these things. Look, Dave, there are so many questions here. Yes, I've got about 20 more text messages that we haven't been able to answer. So if I haven't asked your question, I do apologise. But we are coming to a close for this evening. It's been a great pleasure to have you join us, Dave, and to have all of you come and join us here at St. George's for this inaugural Henry Baldwin lecture. We do hope that you've enjoyed the discussion tonight. I feel like we've covered actually some pretty heavy stuff. Really thank you for your honesty and vulnerability with us, Dave, and for you as questioners as well in sharing something of yourselves. I did want to say that if tonight has raised anything for you personally and you do need somebody to talk to, we do have some people available at the end of the event. So I've got John and Jean up on the corner over here, if you guys want to wave your hands, and Tristan and Marilyn, who are in the audience, but will be over this side if you do need somebody to talk to. And you can also call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Dave, I felt you left a little bit of a space there when you talked about joining different groups of kind of solidarity, and where you kind of meet people who are different from you, but you get to hang out and kind of find a love and commitment to each other. In my books, that sounds a little bit like church.
Sure.
Was that being kind to the audience there?
Yeah, sure. Depending on the church.
And yeah.
Victor is a good man. I've known him for a long time. My message is usually, I'm not a particularly good Christian, and so often what I say is, just go to church because I have to, so why don't you?
Yeah, fair enough. Well, I do too. Like, oh my goodness.
Well, you're paid to go.
That's what keeps me there. Look, we do meet together every week at St. George's on a Sunday, and I hope it's a place that people find friendship and a place where we do. Well, it's definitely a very diverse community, which is one of the things that I really enjoy about it. And we meet together to sing and to pray, read the scriptures, reflect on life together, and try and work out how to be human together. And everyone's welcome. Not everyone are believers at St. George's, which is one of the most interesting things for me. I really enjoy working out life and faith with people. So you're very welcome on a Sunday, 8 or 10 o'clock here. And as we meet, we encounter God's love for us, that kind of welcome and acceptance with flesh in the welcome we receive from each other. And we work out how to love our neighbours together. So you can find out more on our website. Also, do check out Dave's podcast, The Eucatastrophe. Somebody sent a text saying, can you put the website up for that? I'm really not tech savvy. But just Google the Eucatastrophe podcast and you'll find it.
Yes. Or we're on Twitter, ironically, given tonight's diatribe, at Eucat, that's EUCAT underscore podcast. You can find us.
There we go. I do encourage you, if you come here with friends, then do, hang out and don't be a stranger to each other. If you are here and you're here by yourself, We'd love to get to know you as well. There's a few different thank yous that I need to make this evening. We've said thank you to Jonathan Bekesh for his wonderful cello. A huge thank you to Joel Kettleton from Sorrel Anglican Church, who has put our sound and AV together for us this evening. Can you please give him a round of applause? Thank you. We called in a few favours for this evening. One of Dave and I mutual friends, Andrew, put together the wonderful design work, and Lee Carmichael and the team from Dark Mofo have not sued us for that, so I'm really thankful for that. They thought it was pretty good, actually. I want to thank Nikki and Pip for all their work cleaning and setting up here, and my team who's helped me put this on, Tristan and Rush, Paul, Marcos, David, Josh, Karen, Jim, Patrick, and Mark. And if I've forgotten anyone, my apologies, but thank you so much. Just as we close, there's a bin up the back. You can put your cups in that. If you want to contribute to our restoration project, I need to say this because our restoration committee will rouse on me if I don't. There's a donation box up the back. And we look forward to seeing you again at next year's Henry Baldwin Lecture. Thank you so much for being part of this inaugural one. I'm delighted that you've all made it such a wonderful success. And may God bless you and keep you as you go from this place. And we wish you a very good evening, and thank you for joining us.